The headlines: Iran's president tells the G8 summit that Muslim nations have been the target of organized Islamophobia. In Germany, a further 306 people die of the new coronavirus pandemic as the country sees more than 20,000 confirmed cases. And also in our headlines, Myanmar's security forces reportedly clash with anti-coup demonstrators in a northwestern town, killing at least 11 people. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says Muslim nations have been the victim of organized Islamophobia.
The world of Islam has been targeted by Islamophobic measures that have been occurring in an organized manner. In other words, the values and the lofty goals of Islam have been targeted, and that brings about major economic and developmental consequences for Muslim nations.
Rouhani made the remark in an address to the 10th Summit of the Organization of Developing Countries, known as G8, hosted by Bangladesh. Rouhani said unilateralism and economic terrorism have targeted independent countries and are a serious threat against the international community. Rouhani stressed that the G8 member states, as well as other Muslim countries, have large markets for investment. The Iranian president slammed U.S. unilateralism, saying Washington's approach in bringing the Iranian nation to its knees has failed. More details have emerged about an attack that targeted an Iranian vessel in the Red Sea 2 days ago. A staff of the civilian ship called Savi said an unidentified helicopter carried out a patrol around the ship a day before the incident. He added two unidentified speedboats were also seen near the vessel hours after the attack took place. The Iranian ship was attacked on Tuesday morning off the coast of Djibouti. The attack caused minor damage to the ship. Investigations are underway to find the perpetrators. Iran has condemned the attack, calling it a violation of international law and maritime regulations. Tehran says the vessel was stationed in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden to secure the region against pirates. Well, Iran says it will return to compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal only if the U.S. removes all imposed, reimposed, and relabeled sanctions. Tehran also says it will end nuclear talks scheduled to take place in Vienna on Friday if it finds a lack of progress.
Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, completed their first round of talks in the Austrian capital on Tuesday under the framework of the Joint Commission with the aim of reviving the accord. The U.S. also sent a delegation to Vienna, but Iran rejected to hold direct or indirect talks with it. Tehran and the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden remain in a standoff as both sides call on the other to take the first step to return to its deal-related commitments. Iran says since the U.S. unilaterally left the accord in 2018, it must first fulfill the obligation by removing all sanctions in a verifiable manner. Following the Vienna talks, Iran's top negotiator and deputy foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, highlighted Tehran's stance on returning to compliance with the pact.
We only go back to full compliance when the U.S. has lifted all sanctions imposed or reimposed or relabeled after January 2017 and has verified by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Then we would go for full compliance.
The foreign ministry spokesman also stressed that the Islamic Republic is opposed to a step-by-step return to the JCPOA.
It does not require any talks or actually step-for-step plan. We have just one step, and this is removal of all sanctions imposed illegally against the Iranian nation.
A senior Iranian official told Press TV that Tehran will not accept a division of the Trump-era sanctions into JCPOA-related ones and those unrelated to the deal, stressing that all of them must be removed. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Robert Malley, the U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, have already admitted that the maximum pressure campaign launched by the previous administration yielded no results. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani also said the failure of such campaign pushed the Biden administration to send its delegation to Vienna. Now, Iran and JCPOA's remaining parties are preparing to continue their talks on Friday, but Tehran has made it clear that it will end the talks if found a lack of progress. While the world is desperately waiting for the outcome of the meeting, Iran says the ball is now in the U.S. court to show whether it's serious enough in its promise to salvage the JCPOA.
The coronavirus pandemic continues to take its toll on European countries, just like it's wreaking havoc in the rest of the world. Poland reported 954 new deaths, bringing its total fatalities from COVID-19 to well over 56,000. The country also registered around 28,000 new infections, pushing the caseload to around 2.5 million. In Russia, 365 new daily deaths were officially reported, which takes the overall fatalities to nearly 102,000. New cases also rose there by 8,600 to over 4.6 million. In Germany, the number of confirmed cases rose by more than 20,000 to nearly 3 million. There were also 306 new fatalities, bringing the overall death toll to 77,700. The COVID crisis continues to pile woes on Italy's economy. Almost half of Italian businesses are at risk of shutting down permanently, according to the National Statistical Agency. Max Schievely reports from Rome.
Around 45% of Italian firms involved in productive sectors are structurally at risk. This is one of the major findings of a new report on the competitiveness of productive sectors in Italy, released by the Bureau of Statistics Istat on Wednesday. The report warns that firms operating mostly in sectors of low technological and knowledge content would not be able to survive to a further external crisis.
The situation wasn't very much different before the COVID crisis. Italian firms were already suffering from their usual weaknesses. If these firms don't receive financial aid in the coming 3 to 4 months, they will drown. Non-food activities are suffering the most.
A series of national lockdowns to safeguard Italy's population from COVID-19 and the collapse of the health system have resulted in an economic disaster. According to the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, about 390,000 businesses shut their doors in Italy last year.
The Istat report has found tourism, arts and entertainment, and catering are among the productive sectors that have suffered with great intensity from the impact of the containment measures adopted by the Italian authorities so far.
Takeout food and delivery orders won't save my restaurant. That's all we've been allowed to do for months. Either we reopen in full or we die. We've got bills to pay.
I'm not surprised people have not yet taken to the streets to stage a revolution. I'm lucky to have my pension payments. Many, including my son, are jobless. Many went bankrupt.
Meanwhile, Italy has been swept by protests from north to south over the past days. Hospitality operators, restaurant owners, shopkeepers, street market traders are calling for reopenings as a second round of government economic support measures has been delayed. Max Civili, Rome.
India breaks the record of its single-day coronavirus cases with nearly 127,000 new infections as the world's second most populous nation is grappling with the second wave of the pandemic. India's overall caseload has now reached close to 13 million, the highest after the U.S. and Brazil. India's death toll is also nearing 167,000. The government has already imposed new curbs in several states, including the hardest hit Maharashtra. Officials blame the surge on gatherings and people's reluctance to wear masks. Elsewhere in Asia, South Korea has reported its highest daily infection count since early January, with 700 new cases. Most of the new cases were reported in the Seoul metropolitan area. The government has said it's weighing new restrictions and is expected to announce new social distancing rules on Friday. The health system in the Gaza Strip continues to struggle to provide medical service to nearly 2 million Palestinians as the world marks World Health Day. The Israeli regime has systematically undermined the enclave's health system over the past decade. Asher Shannon has more in this report.
World Health Day is celebrated on the 7th of April every year. For 2021, the theme is Building a Fair, Healthier World. For Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, health inequities are an everyday reality that is rooted in Israel's long-held apartheid regime. Tel Aviv has waged three wars on the blockaded enclave and maintains a crippling blockade on it since 2007. During the 2014 war on Gaza, Israeli forces attacked 17 hospitals and 56 health centers. The Israeli regime's inhumane practices have led to a state of de-development within Gaza's healthcare system, making it extremely hard for health workers to combat the coronavirus pandemic.
The Israeli blockade in place over the past 14 years has battered the entire health system in the Gaza Strip. Hospitals and medical centers suffer from acute shortages in medicines and medical equipment, especially amid the rapid spread of the coronavirus pandemic.
This year's World Health Day comes amid a surge in coronavirus infections in the Gaza Strip. Despite the increasing number of coronavirus infections in the impoverished enclave, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medical equipment.
On this day, we confirmed that the epidemiological situation in the Gaza Strip is very dangerous, and the curve of infections continues to increase. Everyone must take the necessary measures to safeguard their families. We also call on all concerned local and international parties to help us in fighting the pandemic.
Under international laws and norms, the Israeli regime must ensure medical supplies to Palestinians, including combating the spread of pandemics. Experts warn that the health sector in Gaza could soon collapse unless serious steps are made to remedy the situation. On World Health Day, the regime's blockade continues to undermine efforts by health workers in Gaza to provide proper medical care. This is while the situation has worsened in the besieged enclave due to the coronavirus pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Well, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, has hailed a U.S. decision to resume funding for the body. UNRWA Commissioner Philippe Lazzarini said the U.S. move came at a critical moment while Palestinians are struggling with the COVID-19 pandemic. Earlier, the Palestinian premier welcomed the renewal of assistance to the U.N. agency. Mohammed Shatai also urged U.S. President Joe Biden to take additional steps to advance Palestinian rights, but Israel's UN envoy condemned Washington's decision, claiming UNRWA is engaged in political advocacy.
I have expressed my disappointment and objection to the decision to renew UNRWA's funding without first ensuring that certain reforms, including stopping the incitement and removing anti-Semitic content from its educational curriculum, are carried out. UNRWA is an organization that engaged in political advocacy and enables incitement to violence. Therefore, it should not exist in its current form.
Well, the reactions came after Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the U.S. would provide $150 million in humanitarian assistance to the U.N. agency. The former U.S. administration blocked nearly all aid to Palestinians in 2018, which included cutting assistance to UNRWA. The body provides food assistance as well as health and education services to millions of Palestinian refugees. University professor Saad Nimr says UNRWA has focused its efforts on providing services to refugees, and it has not been engaged in any political activity since its establishment in 1949.
But apparently that the UNRWA, once it was established in 1949, till now it's confined its work only to provide services including the education and health and administering the camps, all in all around seven services that they are provided to the Palestinian refugees. None of them is a political one, nor the UNRWA had ever played any role in saying that the Palestinians have the right to return back to their homes. They are confining themselves only to services which, in the first place, United Nations created Israel and the plight of the Palestinian refugees. Now we are talking about more than 6 million Palestinian refugees all over the region. They should also do something for this plight. No country in the surrounding countries of Palestine, such as in Jordan or in Syria or in Lebanon, are able to take care of those refugees.
Nearly a dozen more anti-coup protesters have been killed and several others injured in clashes with security forces in northwestern Myanmar. Local media say troops opened fire at demonstrators protesting against the military junta in the town of Taizé. Protesters also fought back with hunting rifles and firebombs. The Southeast Asian country has been in chaos since February after the military ousted civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi over alleged voter fraud in the November elections. The junta has intensified its crackdown on anti-coup protesters despite international outcry. A monitoring group says more than 550 people have been killed in Myanmar's protests. China has lashed out at the UK for granting asylum at a Hong Kong protest leader, calling it a gross interference in the city's judicial system.
The UK side provides public platform for Hong Kong separatists and so-called refuge for wanted criminals. This is a gross interference in Hong Kong's judicial system and runs contrary to the basic principles of international law and international relations, as well as the principles of the rule of law, which the UK so proudly boasts.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry also called on Britain to immediately, quote, correct its mistakes and stop interfering in Hong Kong matters and China's domestic affairs. On Wednesday, Hong Kong protest leader Nathan Law said he has been granted asylum by the UK government. Law has been living in London since last July. Last year, Beijing approved a national security law for Hong Kong following months of protests there. Britain says the law breaches freedoms in the city, but China says it helps improve security there. London has recently unveiled a new immigration scheme that facilitates the immigration of Hong Kong citizens to Britain. The Russian foreign minister says his country will respond to any, quote, unfriendly move from the United States. Sergei Lavrov also warned that Russia will respond in kind to any new U.S. sanctions. Separately, the Kremlin said Russia has to be ready for the worst-case scenario in terms of U.S. sanctions because of Washington's, quote, hostile and unpredictable stance towards Moscow. This follows reports that the White House is preparing new restrictions against the Kremlin. Tensions have increased between the two sides since Joe Biden became U.S. president. Moscow and Washington are at odds over a number of issues, including the conflict in Ukraine and the jailing of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. Northern Ireland leaders have united in condemnation of the violent unrest between police and pro-British unionist protesters in the capital, Belfast. In an emergency meeting, the all-party executive came together and delivered a statement calling for an end to the destruction of violence. The executive said no matter what concerns exist in communities, violence is completely unjustifiable. Dozens of people, mostly police officers, have been injured in nightly protests that started on Sunday. The demonstrators are opposed to post-Brexit trade barriers between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK. The restrictions are to prevent a hard border between Northern Ireland and EU member Ireland. Critics say the barriers will strain the region's ties with the rest of the UK. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz. The ways to confront sanctions, either begging the sanctioner or achieving domestic forces and production inside the country.
We could take two approaches in confronting the sanctions. One is to go to the sanctioner, begging him to decrease or lift the sanctions that he has imposed on us. Then he will say, all right, you have to do this and that, a bunch of arrogant demands, and then I will lift some of them. This is one path, which is in fact the path of humiliation, destruction, and retrogression. Another approach is to activate our domestic forces. We have good capabilities. We should activate these forces so as to manufacture the products on which sanctions have been imposed. When the other side sees that such products are being manufactured inside our country, he himself will get moving because he wants to profit from the product on the market in other countries. This is one of the main sources of profits for governments. As a result of this, the sanctions will either be automatically lifted or rendered ineffectual.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Our nation has chosen the second path. This is really the case. I see that our dear nation has chosen the second path and has made great achievements. The last one being the achievements related to the coronavirus. If you remember, in the beginning of the spread of the coronavirus, we did not even have masks. We did not have enough resources to produce masks in the country. The same was true of disinfectants. However, a national endeavor was made and as a result, we became self-sufficient in producing masks. Others would steal masks. This occurred in Isfand of 1398 according to the solar calendar and Farvardin of 1399. A European country bought masks from China, but other European countries snatched it away in the middle of the transportation. There was such a shortage of masks. Well, we produced them on our own. Our youth and our people produced masks and disinfectants at home and at mosque. It was really a manifestation of cutting the dependence on foreign countries. And we continued to move forward until we faced the challenge to produce a vaccine.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Thank you.
A new report suggests there was a 33% rise in crimes in major U.S. cities last year amid then prevailing anger over racial injustice and police brutality across the country. The report released by the Major Cities Chiefs Association includes murder, rape, robbery, and aggravated assault. It says 63 of the 66 largest police jurisdictions saw increases in at least one category of violent crimes. This as the surge in homicide rates in the U.S. is both historic and far-reaching. The report suggests that a crime surge has continued into the first quarter of 2021. In Chicago, murders are up 33% in the first 3 months of the year compared to 2020, while shootings are up nearly 40% for the same period. In New York City, the NYPD figures show murders has jumped by nearly 14% through March 28, while shootings were up nearly 50%. In Los Angeles, homicides have increased nearly 36% from 67 to 91 through March 30th. Those three cities also saw a significant increase in 2019, too. The increase in homicide rate in the three cities come as Chicago, Houston, and Memphis last year saw an increase of 100 or more killings compared to 2019.
With all of the marches and the protests, some of the word that I was hearing from the street, from people that I know that were out there in the street, the elements, they were telling me that a lot of law enforcement was in certain places. They were just saying, work slow down. They weren't going to be as pushing to go after criminals as you know, from the way they were in the past, because they felt like a lot of them were being thrown under the bus. So I believe that you might, with the if the criminal element knows that and understands that, then a lot of times they will use that opportunity to do the to do their nefarious acts and to go after people to get revenge, everything else, because they feel like they're hearing that there's a police slowdown, work slowdown. So I think all of that, when you add all of that into it, and then you add the economic situation of the pandemic, the fact that people don't have access to the, you know, the resources, money, and the things they did have, it just opened up a can of worms.
Chicago alone saw 18 homicides in a single day, its largest number of murders on record. The surge in crimes and killings are blamed on a number of factors, ranging from economic collapse to social anxiety caused by COVID-19 to depolicing in major cities to the release of criminal defendants pre-trial or before sentences are completed to reduce risk of COVID-19 spread in jails. COVID-19 seemed to further exacerbate things. Officers sometimes had to quarantine because of exposure or cases in their ranks. That especially came into light following the killing of African-American George Floyd at the hands of white U.S. police officers, which set up the largest protest movements in American history in late May last year. It's nearly impossible to attribute any year-to-year change in violent crimes and statistics to any single factor. However, many believe the COVID-19 pandemic, the subsequent economic hardships, and anti-racism protests are to blame for the spike in the number of crimes. But the question is why the U.S. has such a high crime rate.
Well, again, in the United States, more than any other nation in the world, has more guns on the street than any place else. So our gun laws have made it easy for people to obtain weapons. And, of course, a lot of these crimes are committed with guns. So when we look at the extraordinary amount of guns that are on the street, as I said before, the cat's already out the bag. And then the fact that so people have the means to do criminal activity. And then if you have a police slowdown, work slowdown, because law enforcement is upset because they feel like they're being thrown under the bus. They're not being thrown under the bus. And if they feel that way, then you have a work slowdown. If that gets to the street and the criminal element hears that law enforcement is not going to be investigating them the way they normally do, then you're going to have an uptake in crime, in violent crime. That's going to automatically happen.
What's Trump to be blamed?
Crime is out there, and you can't really stop it, which that's been the problem. I don't know if you can blame the Trump administration, other than the fact that the rhetoric on law enforcement, instead of them addressing the issue of police brutality and police misconduct, The rhetoric was like, well, you know, don't do anything wrong. And that wasn't the right rhetoric, because the bottom line is people felt like a lot of groups were emboldened to do things that normally they would not have done before. So in that sense, maybe the administration had some culpability.
There are some other factors conducive to the dire situation in the U.S. Some say America's list of woes appears to be too long. The economy is on the decline, wages are low, economic growth is down, the U.S. companies are not competitive in global markets, and the gap between the haves and have-nots is going deeper and deeper. All these problems, compounded by the highest surge in crime rates, have made many thinkers and observers in the U.S. obsessed with decline, and the concept has ushered a new school of thought, declinism.
President Joe Biden has held his first talks with his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky amid simmering tensions in eastern Ukraine. During the phone call, the U.S. president reaffirmed Washington's support for Ukraine, accusing Russia of committing acts of aggression. The rising tensions follow a series of reported clashes in eastern Ukraine. Kiev has accused pro-Russian forces of killing four Ukrainian soldiers in the Donbas region late last month. Pro-Russian forces controlling eastern Donetsk and Luhansk regions also say a drone attack by the Ukrainian army has killed a 5-year-old child and injured a woman. Donbas has been the scene of a conflict between Ukrainian troops and pro-Russian forces since 2014. The armed confrontations began when a wave of protests in Ukraine overthrew a democratically elected pro-Russia government and replaced it with a pro-West administration. The majority in those areas refused to endorse the new administration. That new government then began a crackdown on the mainly ethnic Russians in the east, who in turn took up arms and turned the two regions of Donetsk and Lugansk, collectively known as the Donbas, into self-proclaimed republics.
I'm intimately familiar with this area, and these people who live there are ethnic Russians. They're slightly different from the Ukrainians, but they're Russians. They speak the Russian language. They're Russian people. They moved there over the centuries, and this is their homeland.
Kiev and its Western allies accuse Moscow of having a hand in the crisis. Moscow, however, denies the allegations. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov warned on Thursday that a possible breakout of war in the Donbas region could result in the destruction of Ukraine. The Kremlin has said the recent military hardware and troops movements near the border with Ukraine have been aimed at ensuring Russia's security and are not meant to pose a threat to anyone. Moscow has also warned against any deployment of NATO troops to Ukraine, saying such a move would prompt Russia to take extra steps to protect its security. The comments came after Ukraine said it would hold joint military drills with NATO in a few months. Over 1,000 military personnel from more than 5 NATO member states are set to participate in the drills. The war of words between Russia and the West has escalated just over 2 months after Joe Biden took office as the U.S. president. Last month, Biden supported a statement during an interview that his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, was, quote, a killer.
So I admire the patience that Vladimir Putin has and how restrained he has been whenever we've had U.S. interference in Ukrainian affairs.
What's evident is that a potential conflict between NATO and Russia would spell disaster for the whole region.
NATO has been in decline for a number of years. And in fact, you look at the U.S. Military's record in fighting wars. They did not win in Vietnam. They've been tied down for 20 years in Afghanistan. You cannot claim a victory in Iraq. They have had the only thing the U.S. is good at is going in and creating a conflict and then sustaining the conflict indefinitely. The U.S. military has forgotten how to fight a war and win. So the Russians have not forgotten this lesson. I really think that this is going to go very poorly for the U.S., and it's going to go very poorly for the people of Ukraine if this aggression from the U.S. continues in order to displace Russia from their territorial homeland.
Considering the recent developments and a flurry of sanctions the West has been imposing on Moscow, another Cold War might be on the horizon, a crisis that could prove even more costly than the first for both sides.
Mali has been plagued by instability and conflict. It was in 2012 when Tuareg separatists allied with al-Qaeda and Daesh-linked groups launched a rebellion and took control of the north. But soon after, the terrorist groups pushed over the Tuareg rebels and seized key northern cities. However, in the early 2013, Malian forces, together with French troops and soldiers from other African countries, drove them out and gained back control. Since then, Daesh terrorist groups regularly carry out raids against the army and civilians in Mali's central and northern regions. In recent years, fighting has spread across the arid Sahel region into Burkina Faso and Niger, with a deteriorating security situation in the region unleashing a major humanitarian crisis. Violence and insecurity have already pushed some 7.4 million people across three countries into acute hunger. Meanwhile, the number of internally displaced people has reached 1.6 million in 2020. That figure included more than 288,000 people in Mali, some 265,000 in Niger, and 1 million in Burkina Faso, which is now home to the world's fastest-growing displacement crisis. At least 1,000 people overall have died in attacks this year, including soldiers and terrorists. First 3 months of 2021 have seen more non-combatant deaths blamed on terrorist groups than the same period last year. The UN peacekeeping force, also known as MINUSMA, was established in Mali in 2013 and has over 13,000 peacekeepers from several countries. Over 230 peacekeepers have died in the country, and that has made Mali the UN's most dangerous peacekeeping operation.
Well, Mali is one of the key hubs for the jihadi African Muslim movement. It's all of North Africa right now. You've got Chad, Libya, Sudan, Central African Republic, even obviously North Nigeria, and then even Northern Cameroon.
France, a former colonizer of Africa, intervened in Mali in 2013 to fight back increasing militant activity. Mali has received support in its fight against the armed groups from France's Barkhane force, which numbers 5,100 troops spread across the arid Sahel region. In addition to Mali, French force has been fighting armed groups alongside soldiers from the G5 Sahel countries, namely Mauritania, Chad, Burkina Faso, and Niger. However, the French anti-terror mission Barkhane is losing support in Mali. Hundreds of people took to the streets in the capital Bamako to protest against the presence of French troops in the Sahel region. They burned the French flag and carried banners, reading slogans such as Down with France. A recent UN probe found France guilty of killing civilians in central Mali. On January 3, French fighter jets targeted a wedding with nearly 100 guests near Bounty Village in central Mali. A UN report said that 19 civilians, as well as 4 militants, were killed. The French Defense Ministry, however, disputed the finding, saying the strike targeted an armed terrorist group. However, the UN rejected Paris's claims.
The French are heavily involved, trying to control their resources. Mali's a very rich country in gold, and it's a very valuable asset. Other than that, surprisingly, it's not that rich, but it has a significant amount of gold reserves. It's considered probably one of the richest reserves in the world.
Paris has intervened in Mali in an effort to stop terrorists advancing in the region. However, there are more important things than the lives of over 5,100 French troops. The African country's gold and uranium mines are an incentive for France's current military intervention in that region.
Shortly after taking office as South Vietnam's president in 1955, pro-American Ngo Dinh Diem began a crackdown on suspected members of the Viet Minh Communist Coalition of the North. The Cold War was in full swing, and the United States, which was concerned about a rise in communism, gradually ramped up its military presence in Vietnam. Washington finally found the excuse to justify a war in the region following an incident in the Gulf of Tonkin in 1963 when two U.S. destroyers were targeted by a torpedo attack by the North Vietnamese forces. The U.S. Congress then approved the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which authorized U.S. military action in the region. The conflict that ensued has been regarded as one of the bloodiest wars the U.S. has ever been involved in. American troops resorted to using warfare, including napalm and chemical toxins, to confront their enemy. Perhaps the most notorious was a chemical substance called Agent Orange that was used during Operation Ranch Hand to defoliate jungles to uncover Vietnamese troops and destroy crops between 1961 and 1971. The substance contained dioxin, which is one of the most toxic chemicals known to man and has been linked to severe birth defects, cancers, and mental and physical disabilities.
You have to understand that America has a different standard for the rest of the world than it does at home. At home, America adheres to fairly high level standards when it comes to herbicides, for example, of which Agent Orange is one. But when it comes to the poor nations in the world, such as Laos or Cambodia, a completely different standard applies.
The U.S. failure in the war and its atrocities in terms of the number of civilian deaths and the use of chemical weapons has tarnished America's image at home and abroad to date. The U.S. rained down some 600,000 gallons of herbicides on the neutral nation of Laos and roughly 19 million gallons of such chemicals in Vietnam. The chemicals were so potent that even American troops got a taste of their detrimental effects. After 14 years of legal dispute, the U.S. Congress passed the Orange Agent Act in 1991 to compensate American veterans of the Vietnam War who were exposed to the toxin. But it wasn't until the year 2000 that Washington started to admit responsibility for what the people of Vietnam and Laos have been going through. Washington kicked off a 10-year project to decontaminate swathes of Vietnamese land from the herbicide in 2019, but stopped short of awarding compensation to the families of the victims. There's also no mention of U.S. chemical attacks on neutral Laos during the war. Even after the American military acknowledged the attacks, a former American commander denied all knowledge about the use of dioxin there.
Laos was a country that was caught in the middle of the Indo-Chinese War. The U.S. Was absolutely indiscriminate in its use of Agent Orange and other weapons of war against the population. It never apologized. It never had any second thoughts. As far as the U.S. was concerned, it was just a collateral damage. So the U.S. has never made good on that. It's never made good on the enormous damage that was done to Cambodia, or certainly the incredible bloodshed that was imposed on Vietnam.
The Vietnam War ended long ago, but not for thousands of people living in Vietnam and Laos who are still being haunted by its effects.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign. to the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Dear and sisters all over the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to The Last Savior from IRIB English Radio. Dear brothers and sisters, we're still talking about the first, or the main question that we started in our previous session, talking about the hadith, about the hadith and narrations, about the starting of the beginning of the cultation of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Based on the misconception or doubt which was posed, it said that the hadith and narrations that narrate this important event, they are contradictory. We have been talking about it with the respected guest speaker, Sheikh Murtada Karimi from Qom Seminary Schools, on this topic, and he told us that we have to know that many people have narrated the beginning of occultation, and even those who believe that the occultation have started right after his birth, actually, there are some phases, the phases of disappearance of Imam and occultation. He needs, inshallah, to distinguish between these two concepts to see what the exact meaning of this is. And so what is important? That there cannot be any contradiction between the hadith that have been mentioned and talked about. So this is what we are going to study and analyze in this session. Sheikhana, welcome, and we need to ask you to shed some light on this issue as well.
Thank you for having me. We mentioned that this Wahhabi scholar refers to narrations narrated by Hakim al-Khatun to mention, to claim that there is a kind of contradiction, because according to one narration, she did not see Imam Mahdi alayhi salam 3 days after his birth. According to the second narration, he did not see him 7 days after his birth. The third mentions that she saw Imam Mahdi alayhi salam 40 days after his birth, and the last mentions that she was able to see Imam Mahdi alayhi salam every 40 days.
Yeah.
Now, we said that, first of all, these narrations are not authentic.
Yeah.
Second of all, there is a difference between occultation, the minor occultation of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and his disappearance from the eyes of the people, and we need to distinguish between the two.
Mm-hmm.
When we say that, for example, Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, we said that most of the Shia scholars believe that the minor occultation began from the birth of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. But the same scholars mentioned the stories according to which some of the Shia were able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam after his birth. Is it a contradiction? No. The answer is that there is a difference between the beginning of the minor occultation and the fact that the time that Shia were not able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam anymore. Of course, most of the Shia scholars believe that the minor occultation began at the year 260. But even if we accept the year 255 as the beginning time for the minor occultation, it does not contradict the fact that some Shia were able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam during this time. So the difference is between disappearance altogether and occultation, which means that the minor occultation begins, let's say, at 255 or 260, but because Shia need time to get used to that, disappearance of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam from the eyes of the Shia, it happens in a gradual manner. And that is why some Shia are able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam after his birth.
Mm-hmm. Although, and even in the major in the major occultation as well, Imam had some relation with the special people from the Shias. So it is not something strange to be accepted.
For the major occultation, because there are discussions about the Tawqi'ah of Adi ibn Muhammad Samari and the fact that, no Shia can claim that I'm able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam.
But at the same time, no one can deny these relations.
That's true. But for the minor occultation, we do not have this problem, at least. I mean, it's not mentioned in any narration that Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam has said that no one is able to see me during time of the minor occultation. So the point is that this Wahhabi scholar has thought that occultation and disappearance of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam has happened all at once, and no one was able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, let's say, after his birth or after the beginning of the minor occultation, and this is something wrong. Now, to continue the answer to this Wahhabi scholar, we want to analyze these narrations that he has mentioned and to see if there is any kind of contradiction between... Today we want to also prove that there is no contradiction between these narrations as well. According to the first narration, Hakima Khatun says that she sees Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam 3 days after his birth. In the second narration, she says that she sees Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam 7 days after the birth of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. Now here, this Wahhabi scholar has lied about the narration. I mean, he has changed something in the narration, because according to the second narration, Hakima Khatun says that I saw Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam on the 7th day. She doesn't say that I did not see him after that. But this Wahhabi scholar has added that Hakima Khatun mentions that I did not see him after the 7th day. Mm-hmm. In the third narration, she says that 40 days after the birth of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, I was able to see him. And in the fourth narration, she says that I was able to see him every 40 days. Now, in the first narration, Hakim Khatun says that 3 days after the birth of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, I was not able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. But does it mean that she is not able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam 7 days after his birth or 40 days after his birth? It doesn't mean that. I mean, on the third day, he goes to the house of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. She says that I did not find him, and I told Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, and he explained to me about the fact that only people with the permission of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala can see him. So the narration tells us that she did not see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam on that very specific day. So if there is another narration telling that she was able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam on the 7th day, can we say that there is a kind of contradiction? No. She only reports that on the third day, I was not able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, and there is no contradiction. Again, in the second narration, Hakima Khatun says that on the 7th day, I saw Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. Does it contradict the narrations that tell us that she saw Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam 40 days after the birth of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam? No. Mm-hmm. She has been able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam in different occasions. Again, in the fourth narration, she says that I was able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam every 40 days.
True.
So there is no contradiction. In different narrations, she says that she has been able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, let's say, after 3 days or 7 days or 40 days or every 40 days. There is no contradiction.
Wherever you be, I'll be with you, 'cause you're the one.
Now, the only point is that in the third narration, Hakima Khatun says that on the 40th day, I went to Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, and I went to the house of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, and I saw him. ثُمَّ فَقَدْتُهُ بَعْدَ ذَلِكَ. After that, I did not see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. So maybe one might claim that there is a contradiction between this narration and the fourth narration, according to which she was able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam every 40 days. Mm-hmm. But again, there is a possibility to remove this contradiction. because when she says that after the 40th day I was not able to see him, it means on the 41st day or 42nd day or 43rd day. But when it comes to the 80th day, she has been able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. So she goes to the house of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam on the 40th day.
Yeah.
And she's narrating the story, let's say, 50 days after the birth of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. And she says that I saw him on the 40th day, and I did not see him after that. But later, I mean, after 80 days, again, she's able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. So you see, again, there is no contradiction between the these two narrations. She has been able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam on the 40th day. She may have thought that she will not be able to see him anymore. But again, on the 80th day, she's been able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, and that is why in one of the narrations she says that I was able to see him every 40 days.
Sheikh, it looks a bit, I don't know, this kind of reasoning doesn't catch us that much, because a lady like Hakim Khatun, if she says something, so she meant that she was not that present to be seen, for example, by that day. I don't know, if you want to say that she could see him every 40 days, that's okay. She might have had this ability to see him every 40 days. But to see that he saw him on 40th, but not 41st, not 42nd, on 48th, I don't know, it looks like...
No, the point is that, first of all, Hakim Khatun is a great, virtuous lady. There is no doubt about that.
So when she says something, so it, she meant true. It. But I mean, she meant something to tell us. The imam was absent or he was in occultation.
That's true. But the point is that at the end of the day, she is not an infallible imam. She is not blessed with a divine knowledge. Mm-hmm. Now, my point is that... the time when Hakim Khatun has mentioned this narration that I saw Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam 40 days after his birth and I did not see him after that. So when did she say this narration? At least it is possible that she has mentioned this narration between the 40th day and the 80th day, because she does not know that in future, on the 80th day, she will be able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. So in between, in these 40 days, in this gap, when she is narrating the story, she mentions that I saw Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam on the 40th day, but after that, I was not able to see him. On the 80th day, again, she sees Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam.
So she could see him every 40 days.
But she comes to this conclusion after the 80th day, not before that. That is why I'm saying that she doesn't have the divine knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Between the 40th day and 80th day, we have a gap of 40 days.
Yeah.
In these 40 days, she thinks that she has been able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam on the 40th day. She does not know about the future. And that is why she says that I saw Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam on the 40th day and I did not see him after that. On the 80th day, she sees Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam again, and then on the 120th. That is why she says that I was able to see him every 40 days. My point is that if she has narrated the third narration, which says that I saw Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam on the 40th day and not after that, if she has mentioned this narration in the gap between the 40th day and the 80th day, this is something true.
Mm-hmm.
In this gap, she has not been able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, and she does not know about the future.
And maybe for the same reason that he was kept hidden. So during this time, he was kept hidden by Imam Hasan al-Askari alayhi salam.
That is the point.
So this is something that it does not have to do anything with, for example, her seeing him in these 40 days, in this gap. It does not mean that Imam was not available. He was, but he was kept hidden because of the same reason that Musa alayhi salam.